That's it. Good morning. Let's see how the machine is working today. Hi. Good morning, Dr. McLaughlin.
Good morning, Miss Bakewell. How does the voice come over now?
Well, I had a fascinating time finding out a little bit about Mrs. Hurst, and I hope you're going to talk about her.
Yes, she was a very important person in my life, and a very lovely memory.
Yes, she must indeed have been.
And now, with the burning down of the old place, you know, about 6 months ago, or it's less than that, by that, the physical side of that chapter seems almost closed.
Yes. Now, I note that it was called the Hacienda del Pozo de la Verona.
Yes, that's the house of the Well of Verona.
The Well of Verona.
And it was named that because she had acquired a very beautiful well curving from Verona. It's a beautiful thing. It's down in San Simeon now.
Oh. Mm-hmm.
And it was in the center of the patio at the old hacienda. And the house was really, in a sense, built around that very lovely well curving. I don't know the date of the curving, but I imagine it's something around the 14th century. A marble carved out of limestone or a marble, and very graceful. And you can see it at San Simeon and the lower plaza on the south side.
Yes, I have seen that.
Really lovely thing.
Well, my little Spanish-English dictionary gave the definition of pozo as being either well or mine shaft.
Yes. Yes.
And I thought mine shaft was a very appropriate thing.
Very. Now that's an interesting point. That is true. Pozo is a mine shaft. It's rather.
It's appropriate, isn't it?
There was no mine shaft down at the old hacienda. So it was the. Well, it's the curving around a hole in the ground.
Yeah, really. I see. Many holes in the ground.
And. There was no well under this, it was just the well curbing. If you've been in Venice, you've seen nearly every plaza has one of these well curbing around the well. The well goes down, that's the way Venice got its water. And some of the well curbings had a little ironwork above and a wheel so that the buckets could be pulled up. But on this well curbing, which is down in San Simeon, you can see the grooves around the side where the chains were pulled up as they pulled up buckets over the side of the well curbing.
Well, that's really.
So you look at that when you're in San Simeon next.
Right. Well, this takes us back into your early days.
And then she called the railroad station. They had a little flag station on the railroad line there. It was called Verona.
I see.
And I noticed in going by the other day that the station has disappeared entirely, but the crossroad from one side of the valley there to the other is called Verona Road.
So it has
yes.
stayed.
So that name is still there. And then when the Western Pacific Railroad was built through the fields below the house, the station on the Western Pacific was named Hacienda. And that's disappeared too. But they were just flag stations. But in the early days, most of the guests went down there by train.
Now, when the guests would come from Berkeley, would they come into the hacienda flag station? Would that be the
yes.
point?
In my early years, that is back when I was a little boy in the high school age, why, it was really before anybody had automobiles, speak of, and everybody went down by train, a little bit awkward from Berkeley, and I did that so often, you go down to First and Broadway in Oakland on the trolley, and then take the train there, that went down through Hayward's and Niles, and up through the Niles Canyon, And the train would stop at the little flag station, and on the weekends there would be, oh, half a dozen, or if necessary, lovely carriages with beautiful horses, and coachmen, footmen on them. They would get in, be driven at a very lively trot up the road and up through the gates and then up the hill to the house up on the hill. There was, of course, then nothing except a few farms around there.
How long did the train ride?
It was about an hour's ride, more than an hour, I think. Of course, it was not a main line, though I think that was an old main line of the railroad, but the they were just local trains stopped half a dozen times on the way down. Then after the automobile came in, where most of the guests would go up to Pleasanton on the train and then be driven by car over from Pleasanton, for it didn't take much longer. Then, of course, even in my college year, the automobile was gradually replacing the train. Though, and Mrs. Hirsch gave a big party for my class in 1914. She had a private train, pretty good one, long one, on the Western Pacific, that brought all the students, all the class, up to the station and took them up to the house.
Well, was the fact that you were in the class part of the reason she gave
them? Well, I rather think so.
I think so, too.
She had had parties before for classes, but this was a very special one. It was a very nice occasion.
How many were in your graduating class?
I think about 600, and I don't know how many went down there.
Well, imagine giving a party for 600 people. There's yes. Something very princely about
it. Well, it was. I had quite a lot to do with the arrangements and so on, get them organized. There was a big tent over the patio. It had been for some other party earlier, but it's a great pole in the middle of the patio, I think in the middle of the well curving, and then the tent spread out over a great deal of the patio, and there's a big circular table around in that for lunch. Everybody seemed to have a good time. Then when the class held its 25th anniversary, it was they went down to what was then the Castlewood Country Club and had their party down there. Of course, it wasn't nearly as nice. Things had changed a great deal, but it was rather reminiscent and everybody had a very good time.
Yes, the situation of the Castlewood Country Club was so beautiful.
Yes, the club didn't live up to its possibilities. It was rather messy, I thought, but they did. There were some nice things about it. They had a nice swimming pool.
Were those the actual buildings?
Yes, the central building was there, but they had added and destroyed a good deal of it and completely changed the feeling of the house. There are only a few little spots around that seemed very familiar. So they did keep most of the patio. In fact, all that's left of the house now is the front wall of the patio and the original gates. The rest of it's all burned down. But that front wall is standing. I don't know whether they're going to keep it or not. And the big music room out at one end is standing. That was a later addition by Mrs. Hayes. And then a rather unattractive house, which was called the Boys' House, which was some ways off, is still standing. But that wasn't part of the original design. And these additions were not nearly as good as the original design of the house, which is by...
Was this Julia Morgan's?
The original design was by an architect named Swineforth, I think. And he did a number of good things around here. He did the original, I'm pretty sure he did the original Unitarian Church, you know, on the Bancroft Way.
Yes, I think.
Which was saved with those redwood beams. And he did a brick house, which is a fraternity, on the corner of LeConte, I think it is, and Leroy, where the creek comes down through the front of it. And Swineford did that house.
Oh, how do you spell his name? I'm not.
Now this would have to be checked, but I think it's S W I N F U R T. I should know that, and but it could be checked because he's a he was quite a prominent architect. And the old design of the house was really a very lovely thing, the old Pleasanton house. And it seemed a very big house in that original design, the big patio with columns, thick Spanish columns all around, two wings coming out. And then the center part of the house with two rather little towers and copings of tiles on the walls, but with flat roofs, and then huge red terracotta pots for ferns and flowers and little palms. The whole house had these little pots all around, flowers draping over the top of the roof.
Lovely. This was a U-shaped house then, I take it, from your description.
Well, the house itself was U-shaped, and then the end of the U was completed by a wall of about a story and a half with tiles on that, ending with two roundish gate towers, so that as you came up the road through palms, there was a sharp right-hand turn over a causeway, which stood about perhaps 30 feet above the rest of the land, out to this little hill. And that road went straight to the gates. And the carriages went through those gates into the patio. And there was a circular drive, nicely raked gravel, with the well curving right in the middle.
So that was really the first...
It was really a very lovely entrance. The carriages all came in there. And the front door was inside the patio. But at night, the outside gates were closed. That was sort of Spanish custom, I suppose.
Yes.
Then the other side of the house had a series of three terraces with rather stubby, thick Spanish sort of columns, with successive rows of these big earthenware pots with flowers coming down from a third floor, second, and then down to a big porch on the ground floor, from which there was a lovely view out over the valley and Mount Diablo and Pleasanton and so on, which of course gradually disappeared as the trees grew up around the place. And that was really the house with a large, almost living room hall that you went right into, the huge fireplace in the middle, a room we call the library on the right, charming, smaller room, and then a dining room on the left, kitchens off the left, that would be to the north, and another little room with library, and a billiard room, and then the wings with bedrooms on one side, kitchen, servants on the other. Well, there were three floors in the central house, but that didn't, then to the north there was a separate house, also attached by a corridor with little columns and a tiled roof, where there was a tallish tower, which was a water tank, and a lower house that eventually was made into a dwelling too. And then in the other direction, she added a big music room. And Julia Morgan came into the picture then and did some work on the music room, something that added some very nice bedrooms, which became, as I say, so own room. That's still standing. It was mostly brick, but it didn't catch fire.
Now, as you looked at the building itself, was it mostly stucco or brick? Or?
It was mostly stucco, white. It was white, with a good deal of red tiles, and there's some completely tiled roofs. Most of them just tiles on the walls, the way a Spanish building with mud adobe building would have its walls protected by tiles and then a flat roof behind it. That's the way the house was.
It sounds very welcoming.
It really was. It was an extraordinary house, and I think it would have been well worth preserving as a museum piece if it could have been taken, just as it was at the time of her death. Mm-hmm. But she, in her will, I think, specified the house and the estate should be sold down there, and it was. And after some little time, it went. I really don't know the financial arrangements, but it ended up as the country club. It went through several vicissitudes and refinancing and so on. But the property has become immensely valuable because the club is now surrounded by a small, rather little suburban area of nice, very attractive houses. And I rather imagine the land values of that old place eventually became very high.
How much land surrounded the house itself?
There I would have to check, but I should think that there must have been 600 or 800 acres in the ranch, for it went down below into the valley, where it included a lovely area of good farmland. And down at that end of the valley, there was artesian water. That is, wells went down and hit deeper gravels that were held in by the silts above, so that they had a half dozen wells there that would spout water. Well, they that was, of course, an immensely valuable thing in California. I rather imagine it was why old George Hirsch bought the property.
Yes.
And eventually the Spring Valley Water Company acquired the water rights to all that valley for San Francisco, but gave a very generous allotment in the deal, whatever it was, to the Hirsch Ranch. So they had a large quantity of water available. But to pump it up the hill, there was a powerhouse, which is still standing. It's more or less a wreck now, down at the base of the hill with a tall stack. And they had a boiler there. It was an oil-fired boiler. And a one-cylinder steam engine that turned a dynamo, supplied electricity, and also pumped the water up the hill. And I don't know what became of the machinery. I know it may still be there. If it is, there would be museum pieces. I don't think that the machinery is there, but the old building is still there.
Well, this was really a very self-contained little domain.
It really was. It was rather an old principality.
Right. The Duke of Pleasant.
Was very much like that. She presided over in rather a royal way, you might say.
Something very engaging about the whole picture.
Something that just couldn't exist now and was on its way out even then, I imagine. But after all, she inherited a huge fortune from George Hirsch, who was really one of the great mining men of the time, his record of acquiring great, great mines. And those were before the days of income tax.
Yes.
And so this large income from the mines, which was largely left to her, made it possible to live in that way.
Did you ever meet George Hirsch?
No, he died the year I was born, so
1891. Mm-hmm.
So I never met him.
Sort of overlapped. Well, yes. Maybe there is such a thing as transmigration of spirit. You know, maybe.
Well, he must have been a really an amazing person, for he got hold of. First, he had a mine on the Comstock, which started there with a family fortune. He'd had some other smaller properties before that didn't amount to very much. The mine on the Comstock, the Ophir, which he had a big share, was made their first fortune. Then he acquired for himself and his associates, the Haggins and the Tevises in San Francisco, the Ontario mine in Park City, which is still one of the important mines of Park City.
In Park City?
Park City, Utah.
Oh. Mm-hmm.
But they sold that later. And they had they were the dominant people in the original Anaconda operations in Butte. And it got, unfortunately, was sold. But the Homestake, and the Homestake, about the same, a little earlier than the Butte.
Oh, yes, we're going to go back to all of these very much.
So.
Well, that's good to know about them.
We're getting a little off the track, perhaps.
It's also so fascinating, but we'll sort these things out. Was this actually, back a moment to Pleasanton, was it a working ranch? Did they...
Yes, but not anything of great importance. They had a big vegetable garden down below with Chinese gardeners who supplied marvelous vegetables, I think consumed almost entirely by the household, and a big vineyard, table grapes.
Is that so?
Which I don't think they sold any, but boxes and boxes of grapes were sent to Mrs. Hirsch's friends. And when I was at Harvard, I had a box of grapes in sawdust sent to me practically every week in the autumn. They were lovely grapes, too.
What, were they for white wine or red?
No, they were muscats for table grapes and all a grapes. Great variety of dark and red grapes, all table grapes. And then most of the land that was cultivated was just cultivated for hay.
And there were a number of horses.
There were lots, there was a stable, and that stable burned about 5 or 6 years ago there must have been about 8 or 10 stalls for horses, maybe more, and then a big carriage room. I've often thought that what a museum that would be if it could have been just kept intact as it was, for the carriages would now be museum pieces.
Oh, yeah.
And of course, they were dissipated after her death. Nobody appreciated the value of things that were not old enough then to really be antiques. Of course, the time came when even no carriages were used even before Mrs. Hirsch's death. She had several automobiles down there. I remember the original, one of the earliest was an Italian car called the Itala, and then there was another car, a Hotchkiss, an English car. They were all funny little cars. They'd all be museum pieces today. And I think the first car I ever drove was a white steamer, down there. It was,
is that so, different from a Stanley steamer?
Yes, it was, but it was the same. It was the same vintage, and somehow or other, one hears very little about the white steamer, and yet it was a standard car in those days, competed with the steam cars, and it was a very smooth running thing, as I remember, and I think that was the first car I ever drove. Or learn to drive.
That's a marvelous place to learn to drive.
Yes, out in the country, on the dirt roads, or gravel roads.
How old were you then when you were doing this, beginning to drive?
Well, let's see, I think that must have been in my high school age. I must have been about, perhaps 16 to 18, something like that. I don't think you had to have licenses in those days. I didn't do very much driving, I remember. But the chauffeur would show me how to run the car and let me run it, which was a great thrill, of course.
Oh, absolutely, it would be. Well, thinking again of the carriages, did they have two horses to pull them?
Yes, there was one, a big tally-ho, that had four horses, but was very seldom used. I was something of an occasion if that was ever brought out. And then practically all the other carriages were two horses.
Did she have any sort of insignia on the doors?
Yes, there were rather an elaborate monogram on the bridles and on the doors of the carriages. Some were closed, some were open.
How old were you when you first went there?
Oh, I must have been about 9 years old, 8 or 9 years old.
A good age, of course, because then you were able to.
Oh, I enjoyed it all so immensely. Then there were saddle horses.
Oh, yeah.
And the chief recreation down there for the youngsters was horseback riding, or hiking, or there's some tennis courts. And eventually, later, two swimming pools were put in. One rather, what we do simply rather primitive by our present desires, and extremely cold, this artesian well water. And another pool later that was in close to the house, part of the house, which was enclosed, kept heated. So we had some fun swimming.
I suspect that your learning to ride on the ranch helped you when you were going up and down the Peruvian mountains later?
Well, it did. I rather grew up very accustomed to riding over the hills. There were some lovely rides to take there. If you know the place, there's a very abrupt ridge rises behind it, which is, I think it's called Pleasanton Ridge now, which has a rather a smooth rolling top at a very abrupt side on the north. It gradually descends about 4 miles away down to Sonoma. And it made a lovely ride up the top of the ridge and then a rather precipitous trail getting down to the house and vice versa. It's a nice walk now to go to Sonoma and walk up that ridge. You can walk there for about 4 or 5 miles up in that high country. It's private cattle land, but I've never been put off. I've done it a few times.
Oh, and you?
My daughter Jean.
Oh, yes, this is her picture.
Yes, she ought to be turning up very soon. She's a senior and ahead now, but taking in this advanced placement some courses on the campus. She took a junior course last term, got an A in it too, a French course. Now she's taking two courses on the campus. She's just finishing at 8 o'clock. We'll be over here pretty soon. Then Sylvia being up in Davis today, I'm taking her over to school.
Well, good for her. That's very exciting to be able to do this.
So I think she's already admitted to Berkeley, but she has made up her mind.
That's
what she wants to do.
You can't push your children.
Oh, no, it's up to her.
It would be fun, of course, if she carried on.
Yes. So I think it would be nice if she went to East and then, if she wanted to do graduate work, come back.
Mm-hmm. Yes, that would be. Well, thinking again of, you just tell me when you want to pause.
Well, she'll be in.
Oh, she's
here. Walking back from the campus here, so she'll be turning up pretty soon.
Fine. Well, perhaps thinking of your arrival at the Pleasanton Ranch, how did you and your mother come to be there?
Well, that brings us back to the first part of the story. My father was a doctor in San Francisco, an MD, and he died when he was just about turned 40. And that was his, I think it was 98.
What was his name?
William Henry.
William
McLaughlin. And mother was a redhead with brown eyes, lovely complexion, really a very beautiful young woman. And she had to get a job and was employed by Phoebe Hirst just about at the turn after my father died.
And what was her name?
Catherine Hamilton McLaughlin. And she, I don't know all just how she got the job, but I think she was making something, some things for the what was called the Woman's Exchange then,
okay,
that attracted Mrs. Hurst's attention. And Mrs. Hurst asked her to take more or less work for her. And that started the association that lasted all the rest of my mother's life, really, till Mrs. Hurst's death. And she was, oh, it's hard to say just what she was doing for Mrs. Hurst, but it was everything under the sun. Sometimes she ran the house down there in charge as housekeeper, and then she would be doing secretarial work. At the time Mrs. Hurst was, those couple of years she spent in Berkeley, my mother was down here with her and doing a good deal of things around the campus in connection with the entertaining that Mrs. Hurst was doing for the girls. Mrs. Hurst was very apt to be concerned that the co-eds of those days really had no interesting social life, didn't learn the proper things young Victorian ladies should know. So she had a series of musicals and dinner parties, entertainment of that sort, of rather elaborate nature. And I think founded a couple of living clubs here. I've forgotten what the names of them were, and I don't think they're even...
I have a note of those names.
I'm not sure they've even survived.
I think not.
No, they may have become affiliated with sororities or something of that sort, but I really don't know much about them. But she was very anxious to improve the life of the young women on the campus. And mother was very much engaged in her activities at that time.
She sounds very versatile and like a very good person to have around. She apparently could just do what...
Yes, I think she had a very nice way of getting along with people. That really was an attractive person. When she died, just before her 90th birthday, she was still half red and half white. She was I called her a strawberry roan, you know, that type of horse.
Yes.
And I had reddish hair when I was a boy, but my father, who had dark hair, was quite white when he died, even at 40. So I inherited my white hair from him, even though I had my mother's reddish hair.
I think you did the best of both. Now let's see, perhaps I should ask a little more about your mother. Where did she grow up?
Both my mother and father were born in Folsom, California, and their parents were pioneers who came in the 50s. I haven't really made much effort to study just what they did or where they came from, except my grandmother, my father's mother, was English, and I remember her, about all I do remember of her, telling about coming across the isthmus as a little girl.
Yes.
She always called it the isthmus of Aspinwall.
Of Aspinwall.
The English, you know, called the town which is now at the on the north, on the Gulf side, the Caribbean side, the Aspinwall. It's now called Colon. And that's typically English to call it the Isthmus of Aspinwall.
Yes, that's just delightful.
And that was before the railroad, and it was a very muddy tropical trails, and I think she said she was carried across a good deal of men's backs, a little girl, and then came to California. But I really must look into the family record a little bit. But
well, only if it interests you.
Yeah.
You know, I'm sure your interests lie in so many directions.
Yes, I never really have paid much attention to it.
Was your father educated in California?
Yes, he came down here and went to a medical school, I think is now defunct. I'm not sure what it was. It may have been one of the forerunners of the Cooper Medical College.
Mm-hmm. Did you have any brothers or sisters?
No. No, I was an only child.
And did you live in Berkeley then before you went to...
After my father lived in San Francisco, and after his death, I moved over and lived with an aunt in Oakland on what was then called Albion Street, which was a nice tree-lined street. The house was between Telegraph Avenue and Grove. It was a street of nice old gingerbread houses with really attractive gardens. Mm-hmm. And it's become, of course, a very down-at-the-heel neighborhood since. And I took Jeannie George down there to show them the old house. The freeway goes right through there now. It's completely disappeared. But it was that was really on the edge of Oakland, because between there and Berkeley was a good deal of empty country then. I remember going to Sunday school at a red church that is still standing on, I think it's 30th Street and Telegraph Avenue now. Gives a little of the feeling of that old part of town. There are still trees around that, and lovely trees and gardens. And just think how that's changed. Mm-hmm. And then mother was that time was living most of the time with Mrs. Hairston in Washington with her, and I was living with my aunt going to school down there, and even then going down to Pleasanton for Saturdays and Sundays very often.
What was your aunt's name?
Mary.
And McLaughlin also?
Mary McLaughlin, yes. She's my father's sister. She was the guardian of a very elderly and incompetent old person. I think his name was G-E-E. Well off. And had no relatives, and the court appointed her his guardian, and so she looked after the old person, a quiet old man, just needed somebody to look after him, to run his affairs. Yeah. And then after his death, mother then, let's see, I was still in, before high school, built here in Berkeley, and it was a house on Euclid Avenue between Virginia and Hillgard.
Yes.
And that was one of the first houses John Galen Howard built. He had just come here on the faculty. And, of course, we met him down at Pleasanton. He was down there very often. And we lived in that. Well, Mother lived there until the house was burned in 1923. Mm-hmm. But at that time, there was a little streetcar just been built that came up Euclid Avenue and stopped at Hillgard. That was the end of the line. Everybody, of course, traveled by streetcars then. It was very convenient. Trolley cars. And I don't believe there was a dozen houses farther north than the hill that goes up to Cedar Street. It was just empty country up there. Up in here there was a farm house with some cypresses around it and a well. They always put out a bucket of water for the people who went out hiking in the hills from their well. There was a road that went up from Euclid Avenue, continued up Euclid to about in here, then a road took off and went up very steeply, making the steep hill up on the north side of the La Loma area and over to Wildcat Canyon, which is now part of Tilden Park. So that was a very nice place to grow up, with the hills to hike in. That's why
absolutely.
I have such a warm feeling for Berkeley, I think.
Yes, I was thinking came up to visit you this morning, out of all the places you have seen in the world, that you have been faithful to Berkeley.
Yes, yes. I must check up on Jeannie. She ought to be here.
Yes, I'll just turn off the machine. I wonder whether you remembered the name of the grammar school you went to when you were living in
Yes, the in Auckland it was the Grant School, which is over on Broadway and about 30th or 31st Street on the northeast corner. And it was an easy walk across. And that hill, there's just a little low hill, of course, to a child it seemed like a more important hill, had a lovely series of the mansions up there. And one of the mansions was the, remember, a big house. I think it was the Mullers. And the daughter, who was, I guess she must be 10 years old, older than I was, Mrs., I think it's Galbraith, who wrote Cheaper by the Dozen.
Oh, Lillian.
Lillian Galbraith was the daughter up there. Oh, I didn't know them very well, though I had been in the house as a little boy, and on an adjacent street, Summit Street, which was then also a line of nice houses, where was a boyfriend of mine, one of an old friend, Edward Beach. I think he's still living over in San Rafael now. And so I was up on that hill a good deal. Now that's become Till Hill.
Yes, that's right.
And all completely transformed from an area of old mansions to what it is today. I think there are very few of those old buildings left. I don't know of any of them. And then when I came out to Berkeley, I think I was in the sixth grade, and went to the McKinley School, which is still standing. Mm-hmm. That old wooden building on Dwight Way, which meant walking across the campus every day from Euclid Avenue, which was a good bit of exercise. I remember a little boy asked me one time when I was back, this is way back in the 20s where I went to school, and I said, when I was a little boy, I went to McKinley School, and he said, gee, said, I didn't know Berkeley was that old.
That's lovely.
I suppose that old building will be torn down pretty soon. It's not a school anymore. I think it was condemned.
Yes, although I think there are some classes still being held there.
Yes.
Part of the Berkeley High School complex.
Oh, really?
Still, but I was expected to give a sigh and fall down almost.
Yes, it was old when I went there. And I remember the Anna Head School, when I was a little boy in high school, looked old.
Yes, it did.
And it's still there.
And it still is.
It still looks old.
And it's now the Institute of International Relations.
Oh, they're in that, yes.
Yes.
I remember how unpopular I was with Mr. and Mrs. Dewey. This is an aside, but I was chairman of Buildings and Grounds, and it was decided that the university really would have to take that land eventually. It didn't want to see the school putting in a very fine, expensive set of buildings there. So we were negotiating to buy the school, and they were very much opposed to it. I took the stand, this is no place for a girls' school. Eventually, you'll undoubtedly have to move. Though Telegraph Avenue hadn't become what it was today. But just think if that school had stayed there.
Of course.
Perfectly impossible neighborhood anyway. And it was a great piece of luck for them. The university wanted to buy it.
Right.
Of course, the buildings were valueless, but the property was very good. And they received a fair settlement for it.
About what year was this, do you recall?
Well, that ought to be checked. It was when I was chairman of Buildings and Grounds.
I can find it.
Must have been, I guess in the late 50s.
Right.
But there was no pressure put on them to get up and leave in a hurry, but it really made it perfectly apparent to them that the school had to move. And I think at that time they changed it from a proprietary school to a an institution with a board of trustees that could function as an institution you could make gifts to and get tax deductions.
Right.
So they built this very attractive school out in the hills above East Oakland.
Well, you may have really forced a very important decision at the right time.
I think so. And it's too bad they couldn't get some property in Berkeley to keep the tradition up. Mm-hmm. I think they looked at a number of things, even the old Garber estate. Claremont would have been a fine place for the school, but I think, I don't know what blocked that. I suspect the neighbors.
They might have.
But it's too bad we didn't keep it in Berkeley.
Yes, it has.
Yeah. But it's got a good side. It's still an important institution.
Right.
But I remember I was awfully unpopular.
Yes.
With Mrs. Dewey, at least.
Really? I dare say they're reconciled by
now. I think they would be. Though, of course, they're not with the school anymore.
No.
They built the school. They got it started nicely over in the new place.
Right. Well, he has even retired from the Berkeley City Council.
Yes. Well, they're very nice, and they were very, very friendly people.
That's very good. I'm keeping one eye on the tape. I think I'm going to just flip it in a moment or two. Well, that's really interesting that you've at least contributed a daughter to the Anaheim.
Isn't it? That Jenny is gone from the first grade.
Has she?
She's one of the few that started in the first grade. It's gone right through to graduate from the
all the way through
high school, really. Mm-hmm. The 12th grade, which she's finishing now.
Yeah. It's a day school, or is it a boarding school now?
No, it's all a day school now. It was a boarding school. But it really was a relief to get those children out of that building, because it's a most awful fire trap.
Oh, it is. You know, they're still having fires periodically there.
Yes.
That's terrible for children.
It's just a temptation to the sort of people who infest Telegraph Avenue now.
Yes, that's kind of a bad spot.
These are nice machines. What is this machine?
This one is a Panasonic.
A Panasonic?
We have a couple of others also. There is a Sony, and I think another Panasonic. I like these because they're the lightest. Otherwise, I end up puffing and blowing before I ever get the interview.